Hey there. Chris Outfield here. And I'm doing something dumb, which is par for the course, I know, for me, but I'm presenting the second part of New Year's Day in this episode. But this is actually the first episode I'm recording for the story. I had it in mind that when I go to the cabin this summer for the very first time, I'll do my New Year's Day episodes, and then I was going to do a marathon, a daily marathon of episodes, and I was going to get them all done. Let me digress just for a second. Every once in a while, I will wake up with ambition. I will feel like, oh, I need to do this, and oh, wouldn't it be great to achieve this, and oh, if I only worked harder in this. And a lot of times it's about the podcast. It's about calling Big Anklevich up and saying, hey, let's do an episode about this, or let's run this on the show. This is a little aside, but Jason Sanford is a writer who sent us a story years ago. Sent us three, remember? I asked for a single golden hair from his head, and he gave me three. And there's still a story that he sent us in the Doonstief that we've never run. And just yesterday I was feeling super ambitious and I thought, you know what? I'm gonna sit down and I'm gonna record that whole thing. And then we'll get, you know, Renee to do a voice or I'll get Big to do one of the voices and we'll run it on the show. But I had forgotten that it's got a female protagonist and eventually the ambition wore off anyhow. But I get all these ideas of things that I should do, that I could do, that I would do if I had the time and inclination, I guess. I had a couple of ideas for tales of eBay horror that I would record as soon as I got back to the cabin this year. Because the cabin is kind of a creepy place and it's dark. And those videos need to be dark. Otherwise, I see my face. I have this list, this mental list of all these things that I want to accomplish, but it got cold last week and it was raining nearly every single day. And my brother said, nah, if it's raining here, that means it's snowing there. And if it's cool here, that means it's cold there and the cabin won't be accessible. We'll just have to wait until June. And I was bummed about that. I wanted to go to the cabin. It's really cheap. You know what I mean? It costs me the gas to get down there and then whatever food I'm going to eat. And just between you and me, I would have eaten food anyway. So it's like a mini vacation that doesn't really cost anything. Just, you know, the 90-minute drive to get there. And I'm bummed that I'm not going to be able to do that for some time, But that's not what you're here for, is it? You're here for the second part of New Year's Day. And I think, well, it's been a while since I looked at the story. And I don't know if it's a three-part episode or just a two-part episode. But you will know when you finish the episode and know whether the story is done or not, right? Okay, so enjoy the second section of New Year's Day by Dr. Rish Outfield, Esquire. And I'll get back to you on the other side.
New Year's Day. 5. Rob lived three blocks from Britt, on the unfortunately named Elm Street. To get there, he cut through the park, where he'd struck out 100 times over the past few baseball seasons. He was replaying his encounter with Britt in his mind. What he said, what she did, what he should have said, what she might have done. He was sure he'd come across like a horse's patoot, but wasn't entirely mad at himself. It was Britt he was frustrated with. She had mastered her Stevie Wonder impression when it came to love, and seemed to refuse to see how perfect they were for each other. If she'd only turn around and discover that there was a guy who would move mountains for her, dedicate his life to making her happy, see that she was always safe and always felt beautiful, everybody would be better off. He hoped she'd wake up and realize that someday. Rob had a lot on his mind as he made his way home, and didn't pay enough attention to notice any differences in his front yard, garage, or dining room. He closed the door behind him and called, "Mom, I'm home." He peeled off his jacket and had almost made it to the closet to hang it up when he heard the gasp of his mother from the end of the hall. He turned around, suddenly afraid. She came running at him, her arms outspread, a sound like exultation coming from her. "Mom?" And then her arms were around him, hugging him tight, kissing him like he was a toddler with a skinned knee. Rob was coming close to freaking out here. It was sprinkling and nearly dark when Dave reached his own house. The living room light was on, and out of habit, he slipped in through the back door. The sounds of competitive sports came from the television as he pulled open the refrigerator. Infuriatingly, there wasn't a Coke to be found, only beer. It pissed him off since he was the only one who drank Cokes anymore, but thought his little brother might have invited someone over who snagged them all. He left the kitchen, cutting through the living room, where only his father and brother sat on the couch, energetically watching an overloud ESPN. Their talk stopped as soon as they saw him there. "Where are my Cokes?" he muttered, the smell of beer from across the room dampening his outrage. He hated it when his dad drank in front of the kid. There was no reply, and he was about to walk away when he saw the way they were staring. What? They were looking at him like he'd sprouted goat horns.
"Where have you been? What happened? Oh, my Lord, honey, is it really you?"
These and more questions were being posed at Britt all in one breath. Her mother hadn't fainted, but looked close there for a minute. Now she was sitting on the couch, clinging to her daughter, crying and laughing alternately. Britt didn't have any answers for her mother, but had a few questions of her own, such as, when had she cut her hair? Why did she look so terrible? And what the heck had happened between the night before and that afternoon? Britt's mom finally took a breath, allowing her daughter to speak.
"What are you talking about?" "You, honey," Mrs. Peterson said. "Where have you been the past year?"
Britt sat there, letting the implications sink in. It couldn't be. But her mother did look different. The house had subtly changed. There was a new chair in the living room, a new plant in the kitchen, a new rug in the hall.
"What?"
she murmured, looking from difference to difference. Mrs. Peterson touched Britt again, on the cheek, on the shoulder.
"You don't remember? Honey, what happened to you?"
Nothing. Nothing happened. I was here this morning."
Her mother took her hand and squeezed it, as if doubtful she was really there, and afraid she would slip away if she let go.
"That was last year, sweetheart. We..."
Britt abruptly stood and ran to the bulletin board by the phone. The calendar there still said October. But it was October of 2002, the wrong year. Britt gaped at it while her mother spoke behind her.
"You didn't come home from school. We called around, called the police. We didn't know where you had gone. We thought you and your friends had run off somewhere."
Britt turned.
"My friends? Davy Earle and the Schaefer boy. We thought, well, I told them you would never run away from home, that you would call and check in, that you wouldn't leave me worried."
Her mother was crying now, rambling.
"That someone took you, that you'd been stolen away, kidnapped, that you would try to get word if you could, but..."
Britt was in a daze, barely hearing her mother talk. The postmark on a gas bill pinned next to the calendar agreed with her mother's story.
"But nobody ever called. Nobody knew anything. No one had seen you. No one could help."
Britt kept waiting to hear the punchline. Mrs. Peterson wasn't a good enough actress or liar to keep this up. She returned to the living room. The TV guide on the coffee table had a stern-looking Asian man on the cover that Britt didn't recognize. It also had next year's date on it.
The police said they would let us know if they found out anything. But they never did. They thought you... maybe that you...
Britt didn't want to believe it. She walked to the bathroom, afraid to look in the mirror, afraid to see her reflection. What if she was a year older? What if... But she wasn't. She looked exactly the same. Her hair was the right length. Her breasts were as tiny as ever. Even the pimple she'd had on her neck the night before was still there. Her mother was now pacing around the house like an expectant father.
Oh, Britt, sweetie, I prayed and prayed that you'd come back. Then I started to pray that you would be okay, even if I never heard anything. I never stopped hoping. Somehow I knew you weren't. I knew you weren't dead. I never stopped praying. And here you are.
Yes, there she was. The rain had stopped, for now. Dave stood on Britt's doorstep in the dark, grumbling to himself. He rang the bell and shook his head, flinging raindrops from his hair like a wet dog. He had barely been home 10 seconds before his old man, drunker than ever, had started yelling. He had stood from the couch, shook his head, and said, "You little son of a bitch." Dave could smell the sour alcohol throughout the living room, which his brother had apparently tracked mud all over since Dave left for school that morning. I don't need this shit, Dave thought. And he didn't, especially after the bizarre turn of events at the Lemley house. He grabbed his jacket from the closet. Damn thing had been shoved all the way to the back, and headed for the front door.
Now where are you going?
Mr. Earl growled. But Dave simply slammed the door and walked into the rainy night. Dave told Britt as much when she answered the door.
I wandered for a while, he said. Then came here. Figured your mom would feed me.
Britt nodded. That had always been the case, even when they were kids. But now was not the time.
Wait,
she said, her hands windmilling at her sides.
Don't you know?
No. Dave looked at his friend, sensing something amiss, but not what.
Are we in trouble?
They didn't tell you? When you went home?
I didn't stick around. Went for a walk. Had to think. I noticed a couple new houses on Locust Lane. It's been so long since I walked past it.
Britt made a "you're not going to believe this" sound and grabbed Dave's arm.
Come with me. I've got to show you something.
She only made it halfway down the walk when Mrs. Peterson pulled open the door and called Britt's name with the intensity of an opera singer. Britt stopped. Froze, even. Dave looked back. He'd never seen the woman look so bad. She appeared on the verge of a nervous breakdown.
"We're just going down the block, Mom,"
Britt said, not sounding exasperated or complaining, merely assuring.
"Please don't go,"
Mrs. Peterson said softly. She was almost crying.
"Is she okay?"
Dave whispered. Britt ignored him and took a step back toward her mother.
"I was just going to show him a newspaper. He doesn't know." "How can he not know?"
"Know what?" Dave asked.
"Just give us a minute, okay?"
Britt asked her, her words gentle and comforting. Dave wondered if Mrs. Peterson might not be sick. Like, seriously.
"We have a newspaper. It's in the dining room."
She gestured, as if Britt wouldn't know where the dining room was.
"Right inside." "Mom, just hold on," the woman said. "I'll get it."
Britt made a frustrated noise and turned around on the sidewalk, heading back for the house. Dave went with her.
"Hey."
"We'd better stick around."
He leaned in, starting to really worry.
"What don't I know, Britt?"
As they entered the house, Britt's mother appeared, newspaper in hand, like a faithful Labrador. Britt took the front page and handed it to Dave.
"Check this out."
Dave scowled.
"Dude, why don't you just tell me?"
She shrugged.
"It would be better if you just looked. And don't call me dude, I'm a girl."
Dave narrowed his eyes. Was this a game? A prank? What was the big secret?
"Did World War III break out tonight or something?" He unfolded the paper and cursorily scanned the articles. One was about cheap and easy Halloween costumes. There was a World Series prediction, and the biggest headline said, "Bush says end to recession in sight." Mrs. Peterson was standing ahead of them, seeming to hold her breath. Dave turned away from her and back to Britt.
"So?"
Britt said nothing. Dave looked at the paper again, and he saw it. The date on the newspaper was 2002. Rob's telephone began to ring. His mother had just laid down on the couch after Rob got her a drink and was quieted down. The most surreal experience of his life was still going on, and he was more than tempted to drink down a glass of Absolute himself. He walked into the kitchen and picked up the phone, a new black cordless model to replace the awful old green one they'd had his entire life. "Schaefer residence," he said without thinking. He'd always been praised for his telephone manners as a child, and old habits were hard to break.
"Holy shit, Rob,"
Dave's voice said through the earpiece. Rob exhaled deeply.
"You too?"
"This is crazy."
"What did they say?"
"That I ran away or got myself killed or something," Dave said. "Nobody knew."
"Did they tell you we'd been gone a year?"
Dave chuckled.
"A year to the day. My old man even had the police report in a friggin' drawer. He said I went joyriding with you and Britt. I thought he was going to punch me for a minute there."
"What? Why?"
Rob couldn't understand. Sure, Dave's dad was something of an asshole, but it had to be a relief to see his son after a year of not hearing anything.
"He thought I stole a car, went off to the city or something. It didn't make any sense, but you know how he is."
"My mom said something about that," Rob said. "Last night, some guy's car got stolen, but they found it later in Chenugana Park."
"Not last night. A year ago."
"Right.
What the hell happened to us in that house, Rob?"
Rob didn't know. He said as much.
"But we weren't gone for a year."
Dave didn't respond to that, and Rob started to freak out again. He needed to hear his friend's voice. And Britt, how was she handling this?
"Dave? Dave?"
"I saw Britt. She's in the same boat," Dave said, as if reading Rob's mind.
"Oh."
Dave said Rob's name.
"Yeah?"
"Are you okay with this?"
Rob found himself laughing in spite of himself. He felt crazy, but he felt giddy and alive for reasons he couldn't express.
"Dude, my parents got back together."
"What?"
"My mom said he lives here again. That after we disappeared, they sort of leaned on each other. They're a couple again."
"No way."
Dave didn't sound thrilled about it, just doubtful.
"I can't believe it myself, but she says he's due home from work any minute."
Dave found that difficult to swallow. He'd never really known Rob's father, except for seeing him at a couple of birthday functions. But he knew Rob idolized him in the unhealthy way people always look up to those they never see regularly. Dave's own father seemed to have become even more of a prick than before, and his little brother had sprouted to nearly Dave's size all of a sudden. Nice that some good came out of this. Dave was looked at with suspicion and grounded, probably for another year. Worse, his bedroom was now full of boxes and some of his dad's old painting equipment.
"Dave?"
"I heard you,"
he said, trying not to sound insensitive.
"Hey, Britt wants to get together and talk, but it'll have to be at her place. Her mom won't let her out of the house."
Rob looked back, but his mother seemed to have passed out. He sort of understood.
"Can't we just talk about it at school tomorrow?"
Dave thought about it.
"School? Are we even in school anymore?"
Rob started to ask what he meant. Then he understood. They had last attended a year ago. Everyone else was in 10th grade now, a completely different school.
"Whoa."
Britt's mom wants us to go to the police, tell them what really happened to us.
What do you mean?
Dave sighed. She's like my old man. She doesn't believe the story. She thinks, I don't know, that aliens got us or something. Rob hadn't considered that. It was so absurd, it didn't merit... Did it?
What had happened to them?
As if on cue, a bright white light moved across the living room window. A car was pulling into the driveway. Rob's heart leapt. It was his dad, come home. At last. He ran to the window, still holding the phone. He was aware that Dave was still talking, but could only look outside and see the headlights extinguish, the door open, and the man stepping out. There he was, his jacket over his shoulder, moving fast up the stairs. He looked excited. Tears began to well in Rob Schaefer's eyes.
To me, Rob?
Rob put the phone to his ear again.
I gotta go, Dave. I'll call you later.
Rob? Dave repeated. You hear me about 8?
What?
We're meeting at the police station at 8, but Britt wants us to talk before that.
Rob didn't know what Dave was talking about.
Christ, Dave growled, his patience completely gone. I'll have Britt's folks call you.
He hung up, leaving Rob puzzled about his attitude, but not much caring. The front door opened, and for the first time in a lot more than a year, Rob's family was whole again. 6. They met outside the police station at 7:45. Dave's father's truck pulled into the lot, the brakes making an attention-grabbing squeal as it came to a stop. Dave was sitting in the passenger seat, pale and worried, picking at the hole he'd torn in his shirt earlier. He was not enjoying the greatest day of his life. His brother Chad acted like his year's absence was a personal affront to him. He'd apparently spent the last year in rebellion, ditching school, going biking with low-life new friends, smoking. Their father was in agreement that it was all Dave's fault, telling him that it was hard enough to raise a decent kid as a widower when his one helper decided to take a 12-month vacation. This was after Dave had explained what had happened and swore it was true. It was almost enough to make him run away for real. Mr. Earl was still unhappy about the situation, but he was willing to cart the boy over to talk to the cops. There's no way they could blame him for this one. And honestly, he was happy to see the kids were all right, whatever the bullshit story was they'd concocted together. The Peterson girl was waiting there with her parents, her older sister, a brother, some little kid, even her grandpa. Mormons. When Dave started to get out of the pickup truck, Mr. Earl said,
"Stick around. Let's wait for Kevin."
"Who?" Dave asked, then sat there sullenly when he didn't get an answer. The Schaefers pulled up not long after. That Robin kid actually looked happy to be there. Kevin Schaefer went around the passenger side of his car, speaking quietly to his wife, and eventually closed the door again. He told them Trudy was sick and would stay in the car, but Carl Earl recognized a drunk woman when he saw one. Dave was surprised to see Rob's dad, arm around his boy, come over and greet his own father warmly.
"Carl?"
"Kevin."
They shook hands.
"Hard to believe we're here, no?"
"Yes, but at least it's on good terms."
The man looked at Dave and smiled. "Dave?" Dave looked away. When would this dream end? Very little of it felt real. And what was left felt like a lie. Like Rob's dad. Mr. Schaefer walked over to Britt's parents and greeted them in much the same way. He eyed their daughter.
"I've certainly heard a lot about you, Britt. It's great to finally meet you."
She shook his hand, then looked past him to Rob, who beamed like a birthday boy.
"Britt, this is my dad," he said,
but she had figured that part out. Looked like the deadbeat dad was deadbeat no longer. Mr. Peterson, Britt's father, looked at the other parents. He had a beard now, with lots of gray in it.
Thanks for meeting us. We thought it would go smoother if the kids did this together.
Did what? Rob asked, but was ignored.
Hopefully now we can get to the bottom of this,
Mrs. Peterson added.
Bottom? Britt asked. What's that supposed to mean?
Her mother didn't look at her. She spoke with a strained, over-enunciated voice.
I'm sure I speak for all of us when I say that it doesn't matter what they did. The most important thing is that they're back safe now.
Nobody saw Dave's father roll his eyes. While Britt's old lady clearly didn't buy the story either, she was making things worse with the all is forgiven talk. If a kid screwed up, he should pay for it, even if you were relieved he was okay. As the group made their way into the police station, Britt grabbed Rob's arm.
I wanted us to get our story straight, decide how much we'll say.
Rob didn't think that was necessary.
We say everything. We didn't do anything wrong.
Dave snorted.
The point is, they won't believe the truth. They think we're...
He glanced behind him. All four parents were looking at him, as if this was his fault. Of course, he was the mastermind behind the whole plot. It didn't matter that he hadn't even wanted to go to the stupid Lemley house. Fine. Whatever. He'd just sit there. Let Britt talk. This was her ballgame anyway. Britt's parents had decided the kids could give their testimonies together
to make everything easier on them.
And all three stood there in the station, their respective parents by their sides, waiting for someone to help them. Dave couldn't help but gaze suspiciously at every calendar he saw. All continued to insist that it was the next year. The policeman in charge of the case was friendly, a big-bellied black man with thick glasses.
Well, well, he said, coming out to greet them. Looks like we'll be putting away a certain puzzling file.
Britt didn't know what he was talking about. Had never seen the man before, in fact. He put out his hand.
Detective Weimer. Nice to see you again, Detective, Mr. Peterson said, shaking the hand.
Britt did the same. She felt very lost. Behind Weimer, two other officers were eyeing them in a surprised, almost bemused way. Somebody had lost money on this bet.
I think we can all fit in here,
Weimer said, leading them to a large conference room with several minimalist, stackable chairs around an empty table. There was nothing on the walls in the room, Dave noticed, not even a calendar, and a long mirror conspicuously stretched along the middle wall. Actually, there was one thing in the room. On the table, a large green file folder had been placed. The detective invited everyone to sit. As they did, he told them that everything they said would be recorded. He hoped that would be okay.
What if I say it's not?
Dave wondered, but didn't speak aloud. He'd probably get a good smack for it. He couldn't understand his old man's hostility. Why couldn't he be happy to see his kid like the Schaefers and Petersons were? If nothing else, his pop should be glad Dave was back, if only so he could write him off on taxes.
Where do you want us to start?
Britt asked.
Wherever you like, Miss Peterson,
the cop said, giving her an encouraging nod. As she began speaking, the sense of unreality Dave had been feeling since he saw Rob's father, and indeed since he'd seen Britt's newspaper, now washed over Britt. There's no way this could all be a trick. How could you explain the physical changes in their families, or getting Rob's dad back? Buildings had changed, people had changed, even the weather had changed. It had really been a year. But what had happened to them? Could they have been in a coma or something? She told the story as best she could, with Rob adding unnecessary details from time to time. Dave just sat there, listening. Or seeming to.
The Lemley House,
Detective Weimer mused, shaking his head. That place had been a problem since he was these kids' age. The story ended up being much shorter than Britt expected. After all, what really was there to tell, except sneaking into the house and coming out again?
So what seems to be a year to everybody else was really just an hour to us.
The policeman nodded, looking from Britt to Rob and on to Dave. He lingered on Dave's face for a moment, then looked at the parents.
And that's it?
That's it, Britt said. It's not much of a story, really.
Rob's father spoke up from the other side of the table.
Your going missing for a year and having no memory of it isn't much of a story.
Britt tried to smile at the stranger.
Well, except for that part.
Silence took over for a moment. The sound of rain could be heard somewhere far off. Dave realized there were no windows in the room. Was there something they could get arrested for? Besides the trespassing? Detective Weimer opened the file on the table. It held three smaller files. From the one on the top, the man produced a flyer. It read, "Have you seen me?" and included a black-and-white photograph of Robin Andrew Schaefer and the date he was last seen. The officer lifted the flyer, comparing it with the boy in front of him. It was Rob's eighth-grade class picture, his hair combed in a nerdy, still-wet style that practically bleated "Mama's boy" for all to see. Weimer looked from Rob's picture to Rob himself, then back. They were very different.
"That's not a good example,"
Rob muttered.
"Of what?"
"Of me."
The policeman seemed suspicious now.
"He's right," Britt added. "It's an old picture."
Rob remembered the camera they'd taken with them.
"I took some pictures inside the house. You could develop them and check them out."
Weimer nodded, making a mental note to do just that. Dave very much wanted to see what was in his file. But more than that, he wanted to be out of there. "That's our statement," he said suddenly, surprising himself. "Do you need us to sign something?" Everyone looked at him.
"What do you mean?"
the detective asked, that look still in his eyes.
"I mean that what Britt said really happened, whether you believe it or not. We gave our statement, and it's the truth."
Weimer was looking at Dave now, and only Dave. It was a stare down. Dave didn't buckle. He'd been in a haunted house that very day. No pudgy donut eater on earth could intimidate him more than that.
"What makes you think we don't believe you?"
Weimer finally asked. Dave considered saying nothing, then figured,
"To hell with it. Because nobody does. It's an unbelievable story."
Dave's dad looked at him coldly.
"Then just tell the truth."
"We don't know what the truth is," Dave said. "Frankly, I can't figure out how it's 2002.
"Don't smart off,"
Mr. Earl said, through tightening teeth.
"You're all so sure of what really happened," Dave said, at that moment very glad that Rob and Britt were in there with him.
It was the only thing that kept him from crying, and he absolutely wouldn't cry in front of these people.
"You tell us."
"Stop it," Rob said. "They do believe it."
Dave snorted.
"Come on, Rob. They're just humoring us, like it's Christmas morning and we said we heard Santa Claus up on the roof."
Detective Weimer sat and watched, his expression unreadable. Rob looked at his father, his prodigal father.
"That's not true. Is it, Dad?"
His eyes were big and afraid again. His father took his hand in his.
"No, we do believe you."
"Bullshit," Mr. Earl said from beside Dave. "Tell the boy the truth, Kevin, and maybe he will too."
Rob's dad shook his head.
"I do believe it, Carl. The kids weren't the kind to run off, and even if they had, they would have let us know they were okay."
"How would you know?"
Mrs. Peterson said at once. It was the first thing she had said since they entered the room. He looked at her without malice, as if he knew her well enough to expect something like this. And, it turns out, he did.
"Maybe I deserve that. But the fact of the matter is that they left without packing a thing, without even taking a coat or a car. And..."
Carl Earl started to speak, but Mr. Schaefer just kept talking.
"Without a car that we know of. And then they're suddenly back, looking exactly the same, not a hair out of place. wearing the same clothes they had on the day they left.
Again? Mrs. Peterson wondered. How would you know?
Mr. Schaefer swallowed, managing to ignore this.
While it's an outlandish story, sure. These are good kids, not the type to run away. I've heard all three of you say that. According to my wife, Rob came in this afternoon like it was just another ordinary school day, until Trudy told him he had no inkling that something was wrong.
After seeing ghosts at the Lemley house, Mr. Peterson said, he wasn't nearly as skeptical as his wife, but he also wasn't born yesterday. Rob thought about what he should say, surprised to find people taking sides. But before he could, Britt glared at her dad.
We don't know what we saw.
That was good enough for Rob's father. He turned to the detective. I grew up here. We all know about the Lemley house. Has anything like this ever happened before? Weimer made a noncommittal sound.
Stories, mostly. There is a file on the place, but nothing quite like this.
Maybe if you went there, Rob suggested, you could see what we're talking about, or feel it. Rob left a flashlight there, Britt realized. If it's still on, you'll know it wasn't a year.
Mr. Earl shrugged.
That doesn't prove a damn thing.
It proves we were there, Britt said.
Dave couldn't take it anymore. He scooted away from the table, his chair making a satisfying screech on the floor.
Why don't you give us a goddamn lie detector test? He growled, eliciting a satisfying gasp from Britt's mother. See if we're telling the truth.
Carl Earl seemed to think that was a pretty good idea. He actually looked proud in that moment. Weimer sat still, nonplussed.
We don't really administer, lad.
Or better yet, hypnotize us, Dave continued. That way we could find out what happened during that missing year inside that house.
Mr. Peterson also thought it was a good idea.
How about it, detective?
Weimer shifted in his seat.
Well, despite what the movies say.
I don't want to know,
Britt interrupted, but regretted it. Dave's position was that they had nothing to hide, and this was not helping. Rob's father stood up.
Officer Weimer, if there are no charges against the children, I'd like...
Children,
Mr. Earl repeated. He saw a trio of juveniles in the interrogation room with him, but no children were around. Kevin Schaefer continued, louder. He was getting good at ignoring interruptions.
I'd like to go home and spend some time with my family.
At that, he looked directly at Mrs. Peterson, as if daring her to disparage his parenting acumen one more time. She said nothing.
It will be a few more minutes,
the detective said, both large hands up in a peacekeeping stance. He waited until Mr. Schaefer sat down again, then looked at Britt.
You suggested we go to the Lemley house and investigate.
Right.
While we may do so, you are not to go there again. That place is condemned.
I'm not surprised.
He didn't think she understood.
It's due to be torn down in December. Curtis Lemley, the owner of the house, died in August in a hospital upstate, and the property now belongs to the city. A park is going to be built there in the new year. Maybe a pool.
Britt didn't know what to say. Bulldozing the house was a good thing, she guessed.
I won't go there. I promise.
Me too,
Rob said. When Dave again felt all eyes on him, he merely shrugged. That night, when Britt said her prayers, she knelt beside her bed instead of lying with her eyes closed as she usually did. She prayed for understanding, to know why this had happened, and how it could happen in a world a loving God had created for his children, of whom Britt was supposed to be one of the favorites. She prayed for her family to be able to come to grips with what happened, especially her mother, and that they could find comfort and unity the way Rob's family seemed to. She prayed that she could still achieve her goals in spite of this, and that she wouldn't have to repeat the ninth grade. She prayed for a guiding hand and protection from the evils of this world,
and whatever world she had glimpsed in that house. She prayed that Dave Earle would learn to appreciate her, if not love her, and that if he didn't, that she could be strong enough to accept it. Mostly, though, she prayed that this disturbing event could somehow unhappen. That if the Lord were all-powerful, that he would make time go backward and fix this mistake, send her back to 2001, where the world still reeled from a senseless disaster, but where the laws of science and time still meant something. Of course, this was all according to God's will, as she had been taught to say, which, she realized, was a loophole so he could essentially do whatever he wanted, and in recognizing this, Britt added,
"If that's out of the question, Heavenly Father, and you know what's best for me, then please, don't ever let me remember what I saw in that house."
She prayed for a long time, longer than she ever remembered praying before. 7. Rob Schaefer stayed up late that night, casually chatting with his parents on the living room couch. As many questions as they had for him, he had more for them. After all, he had only been away for about 8 hours, and they had been gone for a year, at least as he saw it. His mom had recovered from her little bottle break, and he was astounded by how different she was, how different they both were. His parents had never given up hope that Rob would turn up, and had leaned on each other for support during the long wait, and had been rewarded. They held hands through most of the conversation, and when he got up to go to the bathroom, he came back to find them kissing. It was great. At about 11, once the talk of ghosts and haunted houses had faded, Rob and family found themselves laughing, telling stories of incidents that happened while they were apart, either during the mystery year Rob was in the house, or the stretch of years Kevin Peterson had been separate from them. Mrs. Peterson beamed at her son and said,
"Tell your dad about your first kiss."
He eyed her confusedly.
"What do you mean?"
"That game, the one you played instead of going to the Christmas dance 2 years ago."
Rob blinked. First of all, it hadn't even been 1 year ago. And second, how could she possibly know about it?
"Oh,"
Mom realized, putting her hand on his shoulder.
"Sorry. When you were gone, I read through your journal. I hope that was okay."
For a moment, it most decidedly wasn't. All of his private thoughts, his personal experiences, his worries and dreams and fears, his innermost fantasies. But then his father said, "Son, we didn't know where you'd gone. We were worried about you. Trudy thought you might have left a clue on your computer. You understand?" And with that, it was okay. Rob was embarrassed, sure. But if a little blushing and hassle at the police station was the price he had to pay to have a real, honest-to-God family again, then so be it. He told the story of how a bunch of kids, Rob included, had snuck out of the 8th grade dance and played suck and blow on the soccer field outside. In that game, a playing card was passed from person to person by sticking it to the lips and creating enough suction so it didn't fall. The trick was to release the suction at the exact moment the person next to you turned on theirs. A couple of mouths had met accidentally when the card had fallen at that crucial moment, and Rob, knowing he'd never get a chance to really kiss Brandy Cooperton, purposely let go of his right before their mouths touched. It wasn't technically his first kiss, but it had been close enough for a sprawling, fanciful diary entry from Rob that night. And it was certainly good for a laugh in the retelling. In Dave's dream, he was chasing after Rob, who was running into the hall after Britt. Rob had stopped in front of a closed door, and as Dave reached him, Rob was trying the door, unable to get it open.
"Is she all right?"
Dave asked his friend, aware that they should have gotten out of the Lemley house when they'd first heard that awful sound. Better yet, they should never have gone in the first place. Rob shoved himself against the old wood, hitting it hard with his shoulder, but not hard enough to burst through the door. Rob shouted Britt's name, but there was no response. Dave gently moved Rob out of the way.
"I got it," he said,
then kicked right under the knob, cracking the door jamb and letting them in. Dave stopped almost as soon as he entered the room. There was Britt, cringing back, frozen with horror. But she was not alone. Holy Jesus! There were so many of them, looking at Britt and Dave with a chilling mix of pity and hunger. So many, but still room for three more. Dave gasped, snapping awake in his bed. Well, actually, it was not his bed, but a cot that had been set up in the room where his bed used to be. His eyes opening, his breath coming in and out in short gasps. He was back in his room, far away from the Lemley house and the corrupt room on its second floor.
Corrupt with what?
Dave realized that he had just remembered what had happened, what they had experienced, what he had seen. But upon waking, it was already fading, and fading fast.
I saw, he muttered, surprised at how high and childish his voice sounded. Faces. There were faces in...
Someone was standing in the doorway, watching him. Dave's breath caught, and his whole body actually lurched as he saw the intruder there. He looked, to his brother's eyes, like he had been awakened with a bucket of ice water.
Sorry,
Chad said, recognizing that he'd startled his older brother big time.
What are you?
Dave began, then stopped when his voice still came out like a little boy's.
What do you want?
I heard you talking through the wall. I thought you might be...
What did I say?
Britt Peterson's name. Then something like, I got it, Jesus?
The boy, now almost man-height, looked at Dave with something that might have been amazement. But it was dark.
So, it's true.
Dave didn't speak. He needed a drink of water.
I wanted to believe you, but...
Chad admitted.
I just didn't.
He didn't know how to respond to that. His little brother and he hadn't exactly been pals before, but Dave had come to view the new Chad as a stranger.
Sorry,
Chad said again, but this one was more quiet, more sincere.
It's okay,
Dave said, but he didn't want to talk about it right now. He wanted to remember his dream while he still held it in his mind.
Are you gonna be...
I'll be fine, Dave said. Thanks.
Okay,
Chad said, and turned to go. He might have said,
good night,
as he closed the door, but Dave couldn't tell. All he was focused on was trying to remember what had been in that room. But he couldn't anymore. It went on like this for almost a month. Halloween arrived and departed, celebrated by none of them, and winter was in the air. Daylight seemed to last a little less time each and every day, and though they'd figured their memories would return at first, they became more and more sure they'd never remember what they saw and did in the Lemley house during that missing few minutes. Or year, depending on how you looked at it. As for everyone else, some welcomed them back into town with warmth and gratitude, while others viewed them with unease or suspicion. Rob's parents were now inseparable, even if the reason they'd come back together was now absent, and almost seemed, well, glad Rob had disappeared the way he did. They were always cuddling and holding hands, and Dad was calling Rob sport and kiddo like he did when he was a little boy, and the world consisted of nothing more than Robin and Mommy and Daddy. But not for long. Before Rob could completely come to grips with the new household situation, they broke the news that he was going to be a big brother. And he found, more surprises, that he was happy about that. Conversely, Britt's mother had become more frail, more paranoid, and less sure of her faith than she was before. How could God allow something like this to take place? Prayer and fasting hadn't brought her daughter back. It was only after she'd lowered her guard, stopped being so vigilant about things, and began some sort of subconscious healing process that Britt had returned. And why had she disappeared in the first place? Where had she gone? Why couldn't she remember? And worst of all, why couldn't Mrs. Peterson reconcile herself with Britt's story? She wanted to believe it, wanted to believe that Britt had somehow slipped into a crack in time and slipped out again unharmed, but couldn't help but wonder if, maybe, Britt was lying, if she might have rebelled against the teachings of parents and church and jetted off to the big bright city with her pals, experimenting in sex orgies and street gangs and a smorgasbord of illicit drugs. After all, she was so thin. If she honestly couldn't remember what happened to those missing 365 days, it could be the work of a brainwashing cult, which were known to use such methods. She wondered, sometimes, if she could somehow convince a doctor to give Britt a physical, find out if she'd been taking anything, if something was wrong with her brain, if she was still a virgin. And then Mrs. Peterson would feel guilty, angry, bitter, and sad. She wanted to trust her daughter. She wanted to be sure about her. Sure she knew her. But she had found, since the last October, that wanting something and getting it were two very different things.
Okay, so that's where we're going to leave you this week. I hope you don't resent me when I break episodes up, stories up. I've never had anybody say that they did, but I also don't hear a lot of feedback on the show. And it's too late now, right? So I was talking about ambition. I was talking about getting ideas in my head for episodes. And one of the things that made me so inspired yesterday, not inspired, driven, that's the word I'm looking for, is I went onto YouTube and there was somebody who had uploaded a podcast on YouTube, and it was a really, really interesting subject. They were talking about the future of the Marvel Cinematic Universe and the future of Star Wars, the future of the, until now, Fox-owned Marvel properties, and they had uploaded the audio from their podcast, but they had done all sorts of movie clips and little still images and little animations to go with the podcast. And it floored me. I couldn't believe that they had managed to do this. I mean, even if they had recorded the episode last week, to have it up in visual format and be this entertaining, this filled with visual delight, it floored me. I couldn't believe that somebody would be capable of that. And in my mind, I'm thinking, well, these are probably those select few that podcast as a job, that their show is successful enough that that's what they do for a living, and they can set aside 3 hours today and 4 hours tomorrow or whatever for the show. Even so, I don't know how long it would take to do what they had done. There were three of them, too, in the podcast, so maybe each one works on a little segment. I don't know. But I was impressed, and I was thinking about our show and how Big and I can't even manage to do a monthly Doonstief episode, and my show and how I try to do a weekly Rish Outcast, and I don't manage. I had, I think last Friday, I had plans. Okay, I'm going to post the episode, and I was too tired at night, and so I was like, okay, thing is, first thing tomorrow, I'm going to post that episode, so it'll be like, ooh, Saturday morning, here you go, and I didn't do it. I did some work, was throughout the day, and I was just like, oh yeah, when I get home, I'm going to do that episode, and I got home, it was the last thing I wanted to do. I didn't end up posting the episode until Sunday night. Even then, I looked at how long it had been since the episode before, and I couldn't believe it, because it felt like I had just put out an episode. You have to think of it as a job and something that you work on every single day. Even then, you have to find the energy to keep going, to keep doing it. And so, watching the video last night of the guy's podcast, I was just like, wow, I need to work harder. I need to do better. because these guys, they are pros. This is great. And I didn't know what to do for the nightly, you know, it was time to record something. I set up my microphone and I had to do something for Marshall for his show. And then I had been tasked with doing an episode of the Cast of Wonders YA fantasy podcast. And they had asked me to do the narration on a story, and then they were going to do full cast for all the characters. But I don't know how to do that, because somebody, and it's not me in this case, is going to have to edit that whole production together. And having done several episodes of the Doonstief, several, I guess, being an understatement, I've always found it easiest if I just record the whole story and all the parts, and then I sub other people's voices in to the master recording. It's just the best way to go, so that you have a base and you have all the lines, you know where the lines go. And it's just to do it the other way, where I only had my narration and I had to figure out whose line went where and, you know, what the format is, whether it's like, "Oh, I disagree," Molly said, and then another line from Molly. That seems too hard. And so what I did was I sat down and I recorded the whole story, and I did it with giving all the different characters different voices, which I didn't have to do, but I did anyway. But it takes longer and it's more effort, and it's a shame that no one will hear that version where I do all the characters. And I even considered emailing the author of the story and saying, "Hey, I know you sold this to Cast of Wonders, but would you let me run my reading on my podcast just for fun?" But I didn't do it. I still have to edit it. That's going to take a long time. But, oh well, I said I would do it, and I'm willing to do it. I enjoy the narration, as you know. One of the things that I most enjoy, I almost said that I most excel at. But dude, I don't know. After listening to that podcast, watching that podcast rather, last night, I have to recognize that I'm not the best there is at what I do, at podcasting. I'm not capable of doing what those guys did. The videos that I have done for like Tales of eBay Horror are so basic and so simplistic, and I don't know how they manage these things. Unless, you know, like one of them was an animation student, and one of them is like a professional video editor and has access to just tons and tons of clips from movies and stuff to just sprinkle in. Anytime somebody talks about something, whether it's relevant or not, they had this video that they would put over it. And I gotta say, the visual aspect was just as, if not more, entertaining than the audio aspect. And I guess I'm not a professional podcaster, and so I shouldn't try and compare myself to someone who is. You know, it's like, "Oh, hey, I made 4 free throws in a row." And they're like, "Oh, yeah, well, a professional basketball player can make..." And I was like, "Oh, well, yeah, but that's not what I am." I don't know. I tried to think about what is it that I'm the best at. And the answer is, geez, I don't know. Oh, no. Sean Connery impression, that's it. That's all I got. But I feel like I milk that pretty well. I could certainly put more fake Sean Connery videos up of, you know, him doing the songs and stuff, but I don't know. I'm not a video editor. And Big Anklevich, who is... I had mentioned him before. He's super gung-ho about doing YouTube videos right now. And it's impressive to see him stick with it and continue to put new posts out and have more passion. I feel like he has almost a bottomless well of passion for this. And that's great. And maybe that's what I have for my podcast. And maybe that's enough. I don't feel like that's what I was going to talk about today, but I don't feel like I've exhausted this topic yet. I would like to do a second season of Tales of eBay horror. So far, I only have two topics in mind, two experiences that I wanted to relate. The other day, I grabbed my nephew who has started selling on eBay. And I feel like we could do a whole episode with him of a kid selling on eBay and what it's like from his point of view, because he seems to have a lot of fun doing it. In the same way that Big Anklevich and I had fun when we first started. And he certainly made more money than any 11-year-old should be able to. And as I've said before, I had the idea that he could do this as sort of a part-time job for years. And he wouldn't have to flip burgers when he's a teenager, which just seems like a win-win. You make money, it's not hard work, and if it's fun, then, like I said, win-win. And I asked him, well, if I sat you down to do a tale of eBay horror, what would you talk about? What's been the worst thing that you've had happen? And he said, probably the people that email me and say, will you give it to me for cheap? Will you take $10 for it when I'm asking $25? And I laughed when he said that because I don't know that that's even an annoyance, just sort of a gnat flying overhead that flies away on its own. So that won't make for an interesting episode, but I do want to do some special stuff and I want to put out more episodes and I want it to be better. But it's funny that in all these ideas of ambition, I didn't think, oh, well, I need to write more. I need to sit down and write a book, right? I need to write a short story a day for a week. You know, anything like that. I'm realistic. It's hard to force the muse. And so, to be honest, in the episodes that come, it's just going to be more of the same. But more of the same. And if you're a fan of me, then maybe that's good. Let's see, I should say something about the story so it doesn't feel like what it is, which is a wholly divorced episode going with New Year's Day. I recognized when I did the audio for this that the story is dated. I mean, we're talking 20 years now. And that blows my freaking mind. Because it was not that long ago that I was a teenager. It was not that long ago that this story takes place. And I remember when I was getting ready to publish it, noting that it takes place in 2001 or 2002, one or the other, I can't remember, thinking, well, maybe I should update it. Maybe it should be, you know, 2015 now or something, you know, whenever it was that I was going to do the audio. And I was just thinking of a couple of pop culture references that I could change. And then I thought, you know, why am I apologizing for when this story was written and when this story was set? It is what it is. And I have stories that are a hell of a lot more dated than this one. Stories that talk about video stores. Stories that talk about... I've got a story that talks about President Gore. And so, yeah, I guess it's a little bit dated, but I don't know. I like to think that the themes of the story are pretty timeless. And it had to take place in a certain time period so that I could mark that a year had passed. But I really don't feel like the youth of today is any different than the youth when I was that age. I was talking to I wasn't even talking to her. I was listening to a girl talk about her high school experience and that one of her friends had a laptop and they'd take the laptop out into the woods and they'd watch scary movies. And she named off some of these movies, and they're from the 21st century. And I sighed, and I was like, wow. When I was in high school, that was unheard of. Laptops were unheard of when I was in high school. I wonder if she would see me as like an old fart. I remember One time when I lived in L.A., there was a knock at the door, and I answered the door, and it was missionaries. And then they were there to, you know, spread some gospel message. And I tried to dismiss them, and one of them looked over my shoulder at my Back to the Future poster on the wall, and he said, "Oh, wow, my dad really loves that movie." And that shocked me, because that was a dozen years ago or more. And the guy was saying that I had more in common with his father than with him. And, you know, I'm assuming that this was like a 20-year-old kid at the door. I mean, yeah, I recognize that Back to the Future is 34 years old, and that's a lifetime. But I don't feel like I should be sprouting gray hairs, which I am. And I don't feel like I should be at grandfather age, which I guess I am. It's crazy how fast time has gone by. And I hope that when I reach the end of my life, I don't look back on podcasting as a waste of time. It's possible. But it's a creative outlet, as I've said many, many times. And I don't regret writing. I don't regret writing stories, even if stories are bad. I don't regret those. You know, going out and spending time with my friends, even if we went and saw a bad movie together or something like that, I don't know that I regret that because of the company. Well, now I feel sorry for myself. That was not the intent of this episode. The intent was to present the second part of New Year's Day, and I've done that. And I'm going to let you go. And then next time, I think we'll finish New Year's Day, and I'll talk about the ending. And probably the time before next time, I will sit down and introduce New Year's Day, because I haven't done that yet. It was, like I said, it was a cabin episode. I don't know why I do what I do, but I'm going to continue to do it. So thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting me on Patreon, if you do. If you don't, please consider it. Please consider giving me a good review over on iTunes or on Podfather. What's it called? Google Play. I really don't know where people find podcasts anymore. I guess I am old. I'm going to take out my dentures now and leave you until next time. I've been Rish Outfield, and all is quiet on New Year's Day. I want to be with you. Be with you night and day. Good night.
Is this thing on? All right. The music in the show was by Kevin MacLeod over at incompetech.com. If you listen carefully, you can hear Rish in the other room. I think he's crying. Look, this show is released under a Creative Commons 3.0 no derivatives license. That's nothing to cry about, really. Okay, maybe one tear. A manly tear. But Rish really needs people to support him on Patreon. I mean, he's a pathetic barrel full of wet ramen noodles. And not the flavored kind, either. The kind you have to put that brown dust on just for it to taste like anything.
Hey, what's going on?
Hey, Sean, are you talking to the listeners? Oh, I'm sure they've turned it off by now. You've been crying, boy.
There's this movie, The Blind Side. It's really sad.
Because the big black chap has such a tough life and learns what a real family means.
Well, no, because there's so much talk about football in it. There's a love for football in there that just breaks my heart.
And how did you feel about that part where Sandra Bullock gets it on with that huge child?
What? No, that never happens.
It's called subtext, you little lavender wildflower.
Okay.
Anyway, support Rish on Patreon. Between you and me, the television was off when I went into the room.
What'd you say?
Nothing.
Exit only, and I'm stuck. I'm boxed in.
I nearly crashed into somebody the other day. I was driving with my nephew, and I looked. I was in the exact same situation I was in right now, where I was in an exit-only lane, so I needed to get over. And I signaled, and I started pulling into the lane. But somebody two lanes over had done the exact same thing, was trying to get off the exit, and they had pulled into that same lane just as I was pulling into the lane. And I just happened to glance into the side view mirror and see a car right there next to me. They didn't see me at all. And so, you know, I swerved, went back into the turn lane. It freaked me out a little bit. I was with my nephew, and he had been in a car accident just a month ago. And he had been freaked out about that when he would ride in a car because his mom crashed. Well, somebody crashed into his mom and totaled the vehicle. Everybody was okay, but still, it's traumatic for a kid. And for a few days after that, yeah, he was nervous whenever somebody would, like, pull into our lane, or he'd see somebody run a red light. He'd notice it and be like, dude, they're going to have an accident with somebody. And it's totally natural that you become hyper aware of that sort of stuff after an accident. But for the rest of that day, I was freaked out because we came within such a close second from hitting into that guy. And gosh, I feel like, you know what? That can be an outtake. Do people like the outtakes? Do people listen all the way to the end of the show? There was an episode that I edited recently and it didn't have an outtake. There were no outtakes. It was really lean. It was one of those episodes that was like 32 minutes. And I felt hesitant to put it out there in case people were like, oh, this cuts off. They just play the Creative Commons and then the episode is over. So I deliberately sat down and recorded a little bit for the post credits, just in case there were people that were like, oh, I love that. I always listen to the end of the show because he always includes something. I didn't want it to be Avengers Endgame. And, you know, I've heard explanations for why Avengers Endgame didn't include a post-credit sequence. None of those excuses hold any water. It's not the final movie in the franchise. There's another movie coming out 2 months later. Just show a deleted scene or something there. I don't know. I guess I've become spoiled, or I feel like I'm entitled. But, you know, even Infinity War ended with Thanos will return, which was kind of creepy and neat, you know, reminiscent of the James Bond franchise. And I liked that more than nothing. And you can say, no, there was a sound effect. Okay. You win. And see, I feel like a hypocrite because I have complained about post-credit sequences that are really lame. The lamest one that I can think of is the ant playing the drums. I think that was in Ant-Man and the Wasp. And I hated that because it was in the trailer. And so, I don't know. But I remember seeing Spider-Man Homecoming, and it's got the little post-credit sequence with Captain America. And somebody like a row over complained that he's like, we sat in our seats for that, and I felt hostile toward that person. So I need to not be a hypocrite. I guess this is an outtake and a half, isn't it? How long have I been talking? And none of it is content for the show. It's all the outtake. Oh my gosh, we should do that. Where the episode ends at like 22 minutes, the Creative Commons, thanks for listening, British Outfield's a tool, and then there's silence, and then there's 13 or 14 minutes of post-credits to pad the episode into a full-length episode. I don't know. That sounds pretty fun to me. So that's it. I'm going to let you go, but I will be back soon. Thanks for listening.